years it took for the news of freedom to reach all enslaved people in the United States. Register by email to alicem@kutaska.org. Third Coast Chamber Collective presents a workshop on storytelling through music Thursday, June 18th from 10 to noon at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork. Free and open to all ages. Brainerd Community Theater presents Aladdin Jr. now through June 20th at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College. Tickets at clcperformingarts.com. There'll be a send-off for two Bemidji Special Olympians as they head to the USA Games to compete in bowling. Join them Thursday, June 18th with a program at Lucky Dogs at 11:30, followed by a gathering at the Paul and Babe statues at 12:30. And Happy Dancing Turtle in Pine River invites the public to their garden Thursday, June 18th between 1 and 4 p.m. See demonstrations of growing techniques and soil health practices. Their garden team will be on hand for questions. Now we're going to take you back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The three-day G7 summit is coming to an end in the French Alps. President Trump is planning to hold a news conference. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports he's expected to field questions about his agreement to end the war in Iran.
Reactions to the deal have been mixed, as President Trump has yet to release specific details. Catherine Thompson worked on Middle East policy in Trump's Defense Department and is now at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. She says getting to a place where the fighting stops is significant, but that the really hard part is what comes next.
The next 60 days is really where, like, the money of this deal is either made or not made, right?
And that's because the thorniest issues are still on the table. What happens to the nuclear material that Iran still has? And what is the U.S. prepared to do regarding sanctions relief? Franco Ordonez, NPR News, Evian, France.
There were primaries and runoff elections yesterday in Georgia. Healthcare executive Rick Jackson has defeated Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Marlon Hyde reports.
A crowd of over 100 supporters cheered as billionaire Rick Jackson began his acceptance speech.
Georgia cannot afford to get this wrong. We face Keisha Lance Bottoms, the former mayor of Atlanta. She would be an absolute disaster for Georgia.
In a statement, Democratic nominee Bottoms says Rick Jackson is focused on enriching himself, and Georgians deserve a governor who will fight for them when President Donald Trump's reckless policies hurt the state. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
In Oklahoma's gubernatorial contest, Democratic State Representative Cindy Munson won her primary. There will be a runoff for the Republicans between former state lawmaker Mike Mazie and Oklahoma Attorney General Gentner Drummond. The World Health Organization says there are nearly 840 confirmed cases of Ebola in Democratic Republic of the Congo and nearly 200 confirmed deaths. Emmett Livingstone reports this gold mining town in DRC has seen many cases.
I'm in a gold mine in Mongwalu. It's in a valley surrounded by steep green hills. You can hear the sound of a generator, and that's pushing sand down a sluice. Workers then look through that sluice to try and find bits of gold. There, I'd say, maybe 20, 30 pits here. Dozens and dozens and dozens of people are working, despite the Ebola outbreak that is raging in this small town. The workers that we've talked to are from everywhere across eastern Congo. People travel far and wide in search of economic opportunity. It gives you a hint as to how the disease spread from Mongwalu over such a large region. These people are highly mobile and will go wherever they can in order to make a living.
Emmett Livingstone reporting from the DRC. You're listening to NPR. The Pentagon says the U.S. military has struck an alleged drug boat in the eastern Pacific. One alleged drug smuggler was killed. Two other people survived. The Trump administration does not provide evidence of alleged drug trafficking. The motoring club AAA says the average national cost for a gallon of regular gas is $4.03. That's more than a buck higher than before the war with Iran started. The war has also increased the cost of motor oil. NPR's Camilla Domonoske explains ending the war won't solve that supply crunch.
The base oil that goes into synthetic motor oils is manufactured from crude oil and natural gas through sophisticated processes at highly specialized plants. The biggest such facility in the world, in Qatar, was damaged early in the war, and restoring full production is expected to take over a year. The U.S. was its biggest customer. That's pushing up prices. And it comes after tariffs had already made car maintenance more expensive. Nathan Matheson is a mechanic in Poolsville, Maryland.
We see about a 25-30% reduction in our profit margins because of the increased costs.
He says he's been absorbing higher motor oil costs for now. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Yesterday's World Cup action proved to be thrilling. Argentina defeated Algeria 3-0. Star Lionel Messi got the hat trick, scoring all of his country's goals. He's now tied the record for the most career goals at the Men's World Cup. Messi is also returning from injury. He wiped away tears as he opened the scoring for Argentina. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com. This is NPR.
As KAXC celebrates 50 years, we thank the many voices who have filled the airwaves in northern Minnesota.
The 91.7 KAXC, Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Virginia, and Aiken. 89.5 in the Brainerd area, 105.3 in the Bemidji area, and audio streaming on the internet at kaxc.org.
I think it was about 10 years old when I first started going over there with my dad. My dad was a big baseball fan. He loved the game. And you'd go over the Marble, and there was that league that Marble was in was just a tough, tough league.
A lot of community support for locally grown food. So this is going to be a really neat program, a chance to ask a lot of questions.
Idle curiosity is an oxymoron.
I'm Jennifer Barr. You can build the future of KAXC with your voice and support. Give now at KAXC.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Vice President J.D. Vance is headed to Switzerland this Friday to sign a tentative deal to end the war with Iran.
But the details are still unknown, even to Israel, America's partner in this war. So while the two went into this war together, how to end it is driving a wedge between them.
Joining us to discuss this and more is NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui, who is in Cairo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So this agreement is being signed on Friday. And A, I feel like I've been asking this since we first reported on it at the beginning of the week. Is there any more clarity on what is actually being agreed to here?
Well, Iran is giving some indications of what this really centers on, and it's three main points. They say the first is ending the war. The second is that Iran would open the Strait of Hormuz again for commercial shipping. And the third is that the U.S. would end its blockade of Iranian ports. And Iran says that already this week, ships have been reaching Iranian ports ever since this deal was announced. Now, Iran also says that this is a 1.5-page memorandum of understanding, and that after it is signed on Friday, the two sides will sit down for talks on Iran's nuclear program and U.S. sanctions. And for those talks, Vance will be sitting across from Iran's chief negotiator, who is Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf. He's a senior politician and a former commander in the Revolutionary Guard.
Okay, beyond Iran opening the Strait of Hormuz, which, by the way, was fully open before this war to oil tankers and ships, what do you know about what each side gets here?
So Vance has been on a media blitz pitching this as a good deal. He says Iran will dilute its highly enriched uranium and never be able to build a nuclear weapon. And Trump continues to say that once the Strait of Hormuz is open, gas prices in the U.S. will plummet. But Iran says it is getting money, a lot, under this deal. Iranian media say $12 billion in frozen assets will be released in the initial phase of the coming 60-day period, and that billions more will come as nuclear talks progress. But Vance says Iranians won't see any money until they've changed their behavior. But he hasn't denied that Iranian funds will be unlocked in this deal.
You know, Israel and the United States started this war together. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. told NPR on the show yesterday that Israel doesn't even know what's in this agreement. So how is that going to affect talks?
It's important to remember, Leila, that Trump and every country in this region, from Egypt to Pakistan to the Gulf Arab states to Turkey, they all want this war to end except for Israel. This is hurting their economies. But Iran insists that any ceasefire agreement has to include Israel's war in Lebanon against the Iran-backed Hezbollah. And last night, Iran's Revolutionary Guard issued a warning saying that if Israel does not stop those attacks in Lebanon, it should expect a harsh response from Iran. And Iran also says that the first clause of that deal being signed on Friday says that attacks on Lebanon will be halted, but that hasn't happened yet. And look, this is a major wedge issue now between Israel and the U.S. Trump has admitted to cursing at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in calls, and you can hear his frustration yesterday in comments he made at the G7 summit in France.
I'll tell you what, Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long, and too many people are being killed. And you don't have to knock down an apartment house every time you're looking for somebody. Because there are a lot of people in those apartment houses, and they're not all Hezbollah, that I can tell you.
But these wars are popular in Israel, Leila, and Netanyahu faces elections this year, and it's important that he demonstrates Israel's policies are not being dictated by the White House. And he says Israel will remain in Lebanon for as long as necessary, but Iran says it views any continued occupation of Lebanon as a violation of this initial agreement.
That's NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui in Cairo. Thank you, Aya.
Thanks, Leila.
President Trump has said he expects the Iran war will be moving into the rear view mirror. But will it be moving? In a few minutes, we'll hear from Senate Democrat Tim Kaine on what role lawmakers may play in any deal hatched between the U.S. and Iran. But first, we hear how Republicans are talking about this now from NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales.
Even as President Trump claims to have a deal with Iran, there's not a lot of details, and that has members of Trump's own party worried.
To make a deal, it takes two sides. In this case, maybe three, maybe four.
I need to see it in print, but I don't believe the regime will abide by it.
I think it's generous to call it a deal.
That's retiring Republican Senators Bill Cassidy, John Cornyn, and Tom Tillis. So far, Trump has said an agreement to be signed Friday will extend a ceasefire to 60 days to reach a final deal. Members like Tillis need to see more.
You know, we've been here before. We've been in ceasefires. And so let's get to a lasting ceasefire and then a measurable agreement.
The plan could reopen the Strait of Hormuz, address Iran's nuclear program, as well as billions of dollars in the country's frozen assets, and lift U.S. and international sanctions. Senate Majority Leader John Thune argues the administration has achieved something that hasn't been done in 50 years.
To get Iran in a place where they don't represent an existential threat to the neighborhood or to the world for that matter.
Republicans greeted the news of an agreement with relief. They want to get the unpopular war and its domestic fallout, such as higher gasoline prices, behind them. But Thune also says Republican lawmakers need more to go on.
I think we're all hoping to get more information.
On Wednesday, Democrats forced another vote to end the war to get their GOP colleagues on the record. That vote failed, but in speeches on the Senate floor, Democrats like Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin repeated a criticism of the war that could become a campaign message this year.
And no evidence that Americans are better off today than they were before this all started.
Even as questions that have dogged this war may finally get their answers, some Republicans worry it may not be enough to turn a tide of discontent for voters this November. Claudia DeSalles, NPR News, The Capitol.
Let's hear from another voice in the Senate on the memorandum of understanding between the U.S. and Iran. Senator Tim Kaine is a Democrat from Virginia and a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, as we've heard, no official text of the preliminary agreement, but the president said he would send it to Congress for approval. First off, what would have to be in this preliminary agreement for you to support it?
Well, A, look, an off-ramp to a war that was illegal and foolish to begin with is a good thing. So I like the fact that we're in an intermission and hopefully can end this illegal war. here is what I know so far. I have not seen details of the memorandum. I've seen reporting on it in Bloomberg and other publications, and here are some things I notice. The agreement we had with Iran, the JCPOA that was negotiated by President Obama and his team, included a provision on page one saying that Iran would never seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons. The reporting about this deal says that there's a provision that Iran will never produce nuclear weapons. That's not as comprehensive as seek, develop, or acquire. The reporting on this agreement suggests that all sanctions will be eliminated. The JCPOA only eliminated the sanctions against Iran pertaining to nuclear program, but allowed the U.S. to continue to use sanctions against Iran for missile violations, for human rights violations, for interfering with foreign countries. And finally, the reporting on this deal suggests that not only will Iran have access to its own assets and sanctions relief, but there's also a guaranteed $300 billion investment fund to reconstruct Iran. So if the reporting is accurate, the U.S. is giving a lot more to get a lot less than we got in the deal we negotiated 10 years ago. And that's one of the reasons my colleagues and I have said this war was so foolish to begin with.
So my read from you is that it's going to be different, but not in a good way.
Different, but not in a good way. But anything that is an off-ramp to an illegal and foolish war is a good thing. And so I hope that the deal sticks and we can end this war.
Does the president even need Congress to approve this deal?
That's a good question. At some point he will, because I authored with Senator Bob Corker a bill called the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, requiring any president that does a nuclear deal with Iran to submit it to Congress for review. Now, the question is the memorandum that will be apparently released Friday, if it just says, here's what we're going to do on the Straits and on Iranian ports, and we'll keep talking about the nuclear program, if the nuclear details are not really agreed to, then perhaps this version wouldn't need to be presented to Congress. But any final agreement that actually deals with the Iranian nuclear program will have to be presented to Congress. And then any member of Congress who wants to could file a resolution of disapproval and force a vote on the deal.
Now, Vice President Vance said that the U.S. military may need to get involved if Iran does not hold up its end of any agreement on nukes. So does Congress then play a role there?
That's why we're continuing to press war powers resolutions saying the U.S. should not be in hostilities against Iran absent a vote of Congress. We think that's constitutionally mandated. But we also think while we're in this intermission, it's time for Congress to do what it should have done before the war and say, look, we're in an intermission. Let's not restart the war and punish American families with higher gas costs and risk the lives of our troops absent congressional debate and approval. And that's why we're going to continue to offer war powers resolutions to try to get Congress to do what it should have done before this war started.
Senator, one more last thing quickly. Iran wants Israel to pull out of Lebanon as part of this agreement. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. told this program yesterday that Israel will not withdraw its troops. So do you think the Trump administration can persuade Israel to leave or Iran to accept the deal regardless?
That is a thorny question, and I don't have a prediction on that. I do think President Trump has significant leverage, and I hope that he will use it to get Israel to stand down so that this deal can go forward.
All right. That's United States Senator Tim Kaine. He's a Democrat from Virginia. Senator, thank you.
You bet.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'll be joined by Heidi Holton in just a bit. And we'll be your hosts until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Midwest Mountain Bike Festival is June 19th through the 21st at Miners Mountain Rally Center in Ironton. It's non-competitive and open to all with demos, skill clinics, group rides, and more. Find more details at MidwestMountainBikeFest.com. Voices for Ethnic and Multicultural Awareness hosts a Juneteenth celebration in downtown Virginia, Friday, June 19th from 11 to 3. Find free food, music, family activities, and resources on the 500 block of Chestnut Street. Relationship Safety Alliance has their annual garage sale Friday, June 19th and Saturday, June 20th at the Crow Wing County Fairgrounds in Brainerd. The sale runs from 8 to 4 each day with proceeds benefiting services for domestic violence survivors. The 48th annual Land of the Loon Arts and Crafts Festival is June 20th and 21st in Virginia. It kicks off with a parade at 9 a.m. on Saturday, followed by shopping, food, live music, and kids activities both days in Olcott Park. The Coleraine City Band concerts are Thursday evenings during June and July at 7 p.m. at the Longyear Park Log Gazebo. Free hot dogs at 6. Now back to Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Sony Pictures Classics with Unidentified, a new mystery directed by Haifal Mansour. A female police clerk becomes obsessed with solving the murder of a teenage girl in Saudi Arabia. Starts Friday in theaters. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Rolaids, containing a dual-active formula with the goal of neutralizing acid in seconds for heartburn relief. Rolaids spells relief. Learn more at Rolaids.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faudel.
And I'm A. Martinez. In the year 2000, a Mexican film took the Cannes Film Festival by storm. Its plot involved Mexico City in a fatal car crash where three lives collide. Oh, and dogs. Lots of dogs. The film is called Amores Perros, or Love's a Bitch, and it altered the landscape of Spanish language films as we knew them.
It was a new geography in cinema. Of course, Mexico has existed for many, many years, but in cinema we hadn't seen it that much, and we hadn't heard ourselves in our own language. So that's why also in Latin America, Amores Perros had such a huge kind of like thorough transcendence.
That is Golden Globe winning actor and filmmaker Gael García Bernal. Amores Perros was his and now two-time Academy Award-winning director Alejandro González Iñárritu's first film. And 25 years after its Best Foreign Language Film Oscar nomination, it is back in theaters. I recently spoke with the pair about the film's lasting legacy. Here is García Bernal on the early days of this project.
It was perhaps the darkest moment of cinema in Latin America. Industrially speaking also, no? It was very, very complicated that these films would be seen. And so when I was approached by Alejandro to put, would you mind putting yourself on tape and I'll send you the script, and it all sounded very, yeah, like, of course, I don't know, yeah. You know, like there wasn't anything I could compare it to or any, you know, I was also 19, so I was like, yeah, okay, great, sounds like a great invitation. And thinking that this was the one film only in my life, you know?
No kidding, you really thought, wow.
I mean, if I got the part, it was going to be the only film I was ever going to do, because that's how it was. And thinking also like, okay, I should make sure that I get a VHS copy if the film gets finished also. The film gets finished, I need a VHS copy to show to my family.
When you were making it, who were you making it for?
For people like me, like young people, like young. I mean, I was just saying to Gael that I was very impressed when we saw it last year in Cannes, that is still the film holds and has a lot of muscle, and it's very impressive that the dogs are still barking 25 years later. And the fans, the people that is more connected, are 16 to 25-year-old kids. I think that is because these characters are broken, all of them, and they are looking for love. That's what the film is about. And I think that's how a lot of young people feel today. And when we did that film, we were feeling that way too, and we were young, and I think we were doing it for us.
When you were making it, did you know, did you have a feeling even that you were making something that was going to last a long time?
No. No. Back in those days, the crazy opportunity of making a film, I didn't know what it meant. It took me another couple of films afterwards to finally get it together and say, of course, cinema is an exercise of transcendence. And when a film is good, when a film reaches that, which only time can tell, no? When that happens, well, yeah, the film lives forever. Like Alejandro says, the dogs keep on barking. And I cannot understand or see definitely my life, but definitely also Mexico or the cinema world without Amores Perros.
Now, Alejandro, the film came out in 2000, and really, for I think for a lot of people, it is a marker of time, a marker of what Mexico and Mexico City was at the turn of the century. How is the country, the city, similar or different than when you made this?
I think it's very different and very similar in many ways. You know, I think the role of the woman, the role of the men, the fatherless figure, the power games, the social classes clashing. I think the textures and that sound of Mexico, that texture of Mexico, the rawness or the primal beauty of Mexico as an animal that is savage and is lovely and is loyal, but it can kill you. I think all those feelings are still in Mexico City. It's still relevant because of that.
Now, I have one last question for both of you, and it's because of the end of the film, because it ends on a dedication that's really, I think, for a lot of people, taken on a life of its own. It reads, Porque también somos lo que hemos perdido. Translated, because we are also what we have lost. So I'm wondering what that means to each of you. Guy, let's start with you on that.
Well, when I read it for the first time, it was at the ending of the film in Cannes when the premiere was. And that dedication is Alejandro's, and it resonates. It resonates in many ways, and I guess at that point I was just, you know, kind of, it was one of the phrases that also gave sense to the meaning or the mystery of what I had just seen.
Alejandro, what about you?
It's a dedication for, basically, it's for my family, I think, because 3 years before I shot the movie, and 3 years before I shot the movie and 4 years when it was released, my wife and I lost our second kid. So we were struggling still with that loss. And I think without that, I would have never been a director. I think the loss of our son really transformed our lives. And I dedicate that film for him. And more than for him, it was for my family, because I thought that, you know, still he was with us. And we are what we lose. It's a real thing. I mean, when we lose our parents or things, we are still that. We are part of what we have lost, you know. We are made of what we are. And what we have lost is still part of the existence. So, yeah, that's the meaning of that.
That's Alejandro González Iñárritu and Gael García Bernal. Amores Perros is now playing in theaters. Alejandro, Gael, thank you, first of all, for the film 26 years later, and thank you for giving me some time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
The Las Culturistas Culture Awards have serious fanfare, serious celebrities, but not so serious award categories.
In the category of most triggered, activated, and dysregulated I was this year.
I'm Ilsa Chang. Hosts Bowen Yang and Matt Rogers join us on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and it is a dreary day outside, and it looks like it's probably going to stay that way for most of the day, with showers likely and possible thunderstorms, cloudy with highs 61 to 65 degrees, southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, gusts could get up to 20 miles per hour today. Tonight, chance of showers and thunderstorms, cloudy with lows in the upper 40s, north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, though, partly sunny with highs in the mid to upper 60s, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s. And Friday, showers likely with possible thunderstorms, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s, low 70s, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. We receive support from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji, offering hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. More online at hottubsmn.com. And Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 12:30 p.m. Monday, June 22nd on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members of the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The Board's meeting schedule is available at kaxe.org. And we have quite the morning show planned for you today. We have an Area Voices that'll be going on around 7:10 this morning, a little earlier, with artist John Fleischer, who talks about finding the surprise in his artwork. And then later in the show, we're going to be talking to drum majors for the Bemidji High School Meet the Band event. That'll be going on next week. And then around 8:10, we're going to be talking with a couple people about the send-off event that will be going on tomorrow here in Bemidji for two Bemidjians. That'll be going to the USA Special Olympics, and there's going to be a send-off for them tomorrow. And then around 8:40, we're going to be talking with Sean Hill about the Northwestern Writers Conference that's happening next week on BSU campus. And specifically, we're going to be talking about the evening reading series that happens throughout the week. And so, yeah, we've got quite a bit coming up for you this morning. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Residents of Anaktuvik Pass can now use four-wheelers for subsistence hunting in the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. As the Alaska Desk's Aliona Niden reports, it's a change residents have sought for decades.
Mark John Morey has been hunting caribou around Anaktuvik Pass since he was a child. But in the summer and fall, most of the land around the village has been off-limits to hunters like him. That's because residents were not allowed to use four-wheelers in the majority of the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. And that's the only way to access the roadless preserve surrounding the village. But last month, the U.S. Department of the Interior announced it would restore off-road vehicle access to the park. Morey says he's excited.
This is life-changing. I only wish my grandparents were here. Now that we're able to access the lands, we can relearn what our ancestors taught us about certain areas that always have caribou year-round.
The Trump administration has been working to expand access to hunters on off-road vehicles in protected federal lands across the country. However, a National Park Service spokesman for the Alaska region said this action is specific to subsistence hunting in the gates and does not apply to sports hunters. And it comes after decades of back and forth on the issue. Before Anaktuvik Pass became a permanent settlement about 80 years ago, the Nunimut people were semi-nomadic and moved throughout the Brooks Range. Morey says they were searching for their main food source, caribou.
We heard many stories from our elders about hunting grounds that we weren't able to access, which they remember before we even formed a community of Anaktuvik Pass.
The federal government established the gates of the Arctic around Anaktuvik Pass when it passed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. And residents were still given the right to subsistence hunt using snow machines and motorboats, among other traditional transportation methods. But the rule didn't mention ATVs. And 40 years ago, the new park guidance interpreted the law to ban hunts on ATVs because they were not used traditionally. Lillian Stone is the city mayor of Anaktuvik Pass. She says the ban created invisible boundaries for residents relying on hunting for survival.
It was like we were prisoners in our own land for 40 years, where before that it was we could hunt anywhere, we could travel anywhere.
Local native corporations exchanged lands with the Park Service in the late 90s, which made additional areas within the park available for subsistence ATV hunts. Still, residents could only access about 1% of the gates of the Arctic. Stone says residents and local leaders have been advocating for ATV access to the park for subsistence for decades, but with no progress.
We felt like it wasn't getting anywhere and we weren't getting the answers that were needed.
Last year, local leadership traveled to Washington, D.C. and asked the Interior Department to restore ATV access to the park. This May, the department announced the decision to do that. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum wrote in a social media post that, quote, "No one knows or cares for this land more than the people who live here," end quote. A department spokeswoman said in an email the old ban was inconsistent with supporting subsistence. She said the Park Service will consult local communities within 6 months to establish the new rule. Kristen Morey is an Anaktuvik Pass hunter and a mother of two. She says the announcement means a lot for her and her children.
I have no words of what what just happened, because it just makes me really emotional, and I'm excited to be out there and to no longer have to worry about when we have to stop, because I'm out there year-round as well.
The Park Service said local hunters should contact the gates of the Arctic for current information on using ATVs while the regulatory process is underway. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kahonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Coming up in just a bit, we're going to hear more from Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. And I am your host this morning, Andrew DeZingle, and I'm just enjoying a nice cup of coffee. And for anyone who's known me in the last 5 years, they'd be surprised that I didn't start drinking coffee until I was like maybe 26 years old. It was just something that never appealed to me. I would try it a couple times. I remember in college, and I thought it didn't taste that good because I didn't know how much sugar or cream to add to those types of things. And like, looking back on it now, I don't know if just sugar and coffee would do it for me even now. But now I just drink just plain coffee, black coffee. And, you know, I haven't looked back since. And it's been a wonderful ride. And you never know when some new thing's going to step into your life like that and completely change you, perhaps for the better. There's no way of knowing. We receive support from Sanford Bemidji Family Medicine Team, providing care to the whole family from birth to the golden years. More at bemidji.sanfordhealth.org. And we receive support from the Bemidji JCs, announcing their 82nd annual Water Carnival, July 1st through the 5th, by the Lake Bemidji Waterfront and at the Sanford Center. More information on events at BemidjiJCs.com. And if you have been enjoying the World Cup that's been going on this past, well, I guess, yeah, last Thursday it started, so almost a week tomorrow, then you'll want to tune in to the Friday morning show where guests like DJ Deng and Chris Walker come on to talk about soccer or football and give us updates on what's going on in the World Cup. I know the USA plays again this Friday at 2 o'clock, I believe, and I hope DJ Deng is listening because I think he'd be impressed that I knew that. But speaking of events going on, KXC, KBXC, Bridget's Pub, and Kagan Cork host the Beltrami Block Party in downtown Bemidji Saturday, June 27th. Free live music with Eric Koskinen, David Huckfelt, Little Fevers, and more, as well as food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. Info at KAXC's Facebook page, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Regular listeners to this program know what to expect when they hear that theme. StoryCorps. Loved ones interview each other face-to-face, and we hear some of the most moving conversations on Fridays. Many people cry. Sometimes I cry. Now, StoryCorps and Morning Edition are teaming up to create another collection of interviews for America's 250th birthday. Connect 250 is a little different than StoryCorps, and it's an opportunity for you, as we heard from StoryCorps founder Dave Isay.
So we are, for the 250th birthday of America, creating a portal, a site, where two Morning Edition listeners can have a conversation about their lives for 40 minutes, and it goes to the Library of Congress. So we're trying to create a time capsule of who we are as Americans on the occasion of the 250th birthday of America.
So this is not talking to a loved one. This is talking to a stranger.
Yeah. And, you know, it might seem kind of scary, but as you know, talking to strangers is incredibly fun.
It's a thing that I love to do. I will knock on doors and talk to random voters in politically interesting areas. And yet I know some people would never want to do it at all.
Well, you got to try. And that's what StoryCorps is all about. And hopefully that's what's going to happen for the 250th for this project we're calling Connect 250, that Morning Edition listeners will get to talk to a stranger, talk about their lives, and have that become part of American history at the Library of Congress.
What pointers do you give for interviewing someone you've never met before?
You know, it's pretty easy. You just ask that question you've always wanted to ask. You know, the microphone gives you the license to ask things that you may not never have asked before and may never have said before. So it's a chance to get to know someone very intensely, very quickly. And as I said, it is very, very fun.
I think there's a format here, right? Each of you will write a few facts about yourself and then the other person will read them. So they'll have something to go on.
That's exactly right. So you go through a process where you sign up, sign in, and you write a little bio of yourself. And that bio gets shared with your partner, and it's off to the races.
Any facts can get the conversation going. Like you find out that they're from Toledo. What'd you do in Toledo? Why was your family in Toledo? How long have you been wherever you're living now? Anything to get you going.
Exactly. And we also supply the best StoryCorps questions. Where did you grow up? Who is kindest to you in your life? How do you want to be remembered? Those sorts of questions. And just like you cry at the broadcasts, people tend to cry in these interviews, even if it's with a stranger.
Is there something about this moment in history, 2026, that makes you feel it's important for people who've never met to have a conversation?
You know, I think these kind of conversations are important anytime. It could be 2026, it could be 2036, it could be 2016. The point is human connection. And, you know, in many ways, for many reasons, we talk less and less to one another, and anything that opens the door for us to meaningfully connect with another human being is a good thing at any time, at any point. But we are at a moment, you know, certainly in our country, and you can look at the statistics, where there's a lot of fear of others. And it is one of those moments where I think it's important for us to open up our ears and open up our hearts and get to know someone who's different. And there's nothing to be scared of. This is what it means to be alive.
Dave Isay is the founder of StoryCorps. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And you can sign up for a conversation at connect250.org.
Picture this, a line of more than 20 school buses rolling down the expressway. Inside, not students, but rowdy Scottish soccer fans. That was the scene in New England over the weekend when more than 1,000 Scots crowded into a fleet of yellow buses to see their team take on Haiti at a World Cup contest just outside Boston. Riding along was reporter Jeremy Siegel of member station GBH.
It's about 1 in the afternoon, 8 hours before kickoff, when a sea of Scots flood the streets of downtown Providence, Rhode Island, ready to board their school buses. Annie McKay downs a beer.
I have never been in anything like this.
McKay is 87 years old and a lifelong member of the Tartan Army, the chosen name of Scotland's traveling fan base. They're staying in Providence instead of Boston to save on hotel prices. Sam Dunnigan tells me people across Scotland have blown their life savings and taken out loans and second mortgages to travel to the event.
We have no money left. The coffers are empty. The coffers are empty, all right?
To cut down on costs, one fan suggested renting yellow school buses instead of paying the high price for public transport. Yellow buses are an American novelty, unfamiliar to most Scots, and they were shocked to find out it was a realistic option.
We spoke to a few bus companies and the prices were incredible.
That's Scott Gillen, one of the organizers. After doing the math, they found the total cost for the ride, $38 per head, and that includes onboard libations.
So we've now got about $16,000 of beer.
Gillen also says a portion of the money they saved on the school buses will go to local charities, including $10,000 for Providence's Hasbro Children's Hospital. The Tartan army boards the buses in true Scottish style, led by a bagpipe band. A long line of bright yellow buses, all sourced from local schools, meet them outside the state house. Driver Paula McFadden jumped at the assignment when the Scots contacted her district.
How does it feel to be driving this bus?
Oh, it's very exciting. They're going to be a lot of fun to drive.
On board, it is a raucous ride.
Back in the bus, get inside! Get a bike inside! Get your
heat in. The beers flow, the chants are constant. Flags wave out the windows as we drive up Interstate 95. Midway to Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, temporarily renamed Boston Stadium for the event, I'm handed a tall boy of beer and taught how to say cheers the Scottish way. Slangevar.
Slangevar!
Somehow, we arrive at the stadium in one piece. Empty cans are everywhere. The Scots are elated as they exit their yellow chariots and march on to their seats, not knowing that by the end of the night, they'll have witnessed their country's first win at the World Cup in more than three decades. For NPR News, I'm Jeremy Siegel in Foxborough, Massachusetts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steven Skeep.
I got to say, it's been very nice going on social media lately and seeing a lot of videos of people from other countries coming here for the World Cup and interacting with the locals and really bonding over things. Like, I recently saw a video where a British guy and his wife come in to a New York sandwich shop and the owner just really takes to them and has the guy come behind the counter to like look at how the sandwiches are made. That stuff just warms the heart. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and coming up at top of the hour, it's going to be the Up North Report, local news from our region. And one of the benefits of being a radio host is you get to pick music that people get to listen to. And I woke up immediately with this song stuck in my head today. I don't know if it's the rainy weather, but it's such a lovely song, and I think it fits with the weather pretty well. So I'm going to share it with you. Maybe it'll be stuck in your head for the rest of the day. But you know what? That's not a bad thing. That can be a good thing. But I'll let you decide. This is the song Crying, Laughing, Loving, Lying by Lobby Siffre.
Crying never did nobody no good, no how. That's why I don't cry. That's why I don't cry. Sometimes does somebody some good somehow. That's why I'm laughing now. That's why I'm laughing. Loving never did me no good.
did nobody no good, no how, no how. So why am I lying now? So why am I lying now? So why am
And that was Crying, Laughing, Loving, Lying by Lobby Siffre. I first heard that song on the Holdovers movie, and it was a delightful time, and I've been stuck with it ever since. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm joined now by Heidi Holton.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing on this dreary day?
It is a little dreary out there.
You know what? I don't mind it. Sun's not in my eyes today.
Yeah. We were talking yesterday at our house about it being a cooler summer. I mean, we had a couple of big hot heat blasts.
But I would take earlier. A cool summer over a cruel summer.
Yeah, well, yeah, that. But I actually like a summer like this. I'm not a sunny, beachy sort of a person. I mean, I enjoy summer. I mean, I don't know. I feel a little guilty saying that. Because if you live here, you know, you feel like you wait all year for some decent weather. But I've learned to like winter a little bit more. But anyway, yes, we need the rain. Things are way too dry. We're still in a drought situation. The Holdovers.
Yes.
Oh, I need to see that movie again.
Yeah, I'm hoping to watch it around Christmas time again this year.
Yeah.
It is a Christmas movie.
Yeah, I heard the woman who stars in it, was she won the Academy Award?
Yeah.
Or supporting actress, or was it?
Yeah, best supporting actress.
I saw her in a podcast, and that's reminded me, like, I need to see this movie again. She's fantastic. She's, yeah. Anyway.
The boy in it, Dominic Sessa, he's going to play Anthony Bourdain in a movie.
Oh.
About the younger days of Anthony Bourdain.
Sure. Is it, like, based on his Kitchen Confidential?
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know a lot about Anthony Bourdain's, like, writing career. I know he co-wrote some comic books.
Oh, well, I did read Kitchen Confidential, his first book, and it was about it's a hard one to take if you like going to restaurants, because the gritty behind the scenes world of cooking, and also his addictions and kind of life on the edge and what restaurant life is like. But he was a great writer.
And famously, it was sort of adapted into a TV show called Burnt, starring future Academy Award nominee Bradley Cooper.
I think it was a movie, wasn't it? Not a TV show.
Was it?
I saw it, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Bradley Cooper also did a cooking TV show.
Yeah. I think it was a movie. I saw that movie. It's all right. I mean, I like a movie in that setting, but I don't know.
Okay, so Bradley Cooper starred in the 2005 Fox sitcom Kitchen Confidential.
Oh, okay.
They tried to adapt it, I guess.
But Burnt
was the movie.
Okay.
All I can do is apologize.
You don't need to apologize. You knew it. It's a slight difference.
As the pop culture expert on my trivia team, this is nothing short of embarrassing.
Hey, let's talk about that. You get a chance to spend some time with the mom of pop culture very soon.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We are reuniting the movie brain trust of KAXE, where me, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb are going to be talking about movies that came out in 1976, and I'm so excited to talk about it. There's a lot of good movies that came out that year.
So have you guys been trying to see them, or?
I've been rewatching a few, and then I saw ones that had been on my blind spot, like Bad News Bears, I had never seen before until a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, outside of like clips on TNT type thing.
Right, right. Well, Bad News Bears was a big, I don't know when I would have seen it, but it was certainly a part of my growing up, the kind of the zeitgeist of that show and the idea behind it. And because I was a little kid when it came out, and I didn't go to it in the theater, I don't think, but who knows?
It's interesting seeing like Jackie Earle Haley as a boy, because I've only known him as an adult. Mm-hmm. I was never familiar with his.
And I don't know him either way. Career. I don't remember.
Jackie Earle Haley?
Yeah.
The bad boy of the Bad News Bears?
Well, I don't remember like the actors' names, because I would have been a kid, you know, so when I saw it. But what does he do? What is he in now that I would know him from?
I can't remember the last thing. He was in the Watchmen movie. Did you see that? He played Rorschach. Mm-hmm. How about he was the new Freddy Krueger when they rebooted it?
I did. No, I didn't surprise you. No, I did not see the new Freddy Krueger. I mean, it's just not my deal.
I mean, 2010, so it's already 16 years old.
Yes. You know me well enough. That's probably not my forte.
But. I can't think of what else he's been in lately. I know he's in the Green Hornet, I think.
Okay. Let's go back to the holdovers. It's early morning. I'm trying to wake up. The main actor in it.
Paul Giamatti.
Oh, love Paul Giamatti.
And then he went to, was it In-N-Out Burger after he won a Golden Globe?
Yeah. What a guy.
What a relatable guy.
I know. Has he been?
Oh, I don't know what he's been in lately.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything that he's done since the holdovers, but I'm sure he has. He's been a working actor.
Yeah. He's so got long. An interesting family life, too. His father was the baseball commissioner.
Oh, I
know. And also
a
professor. And yeah, like just interesting.
Great. He's a Nepo baby?
Well, if you're in the sports world, I guess, but there you go.
But speaking of things going on today, it's time to check out the national calendar. I'm going to get your live reaction, Heidi, to what we're supposed to be celebrating today. And I don't know if you noticed this, but during the summer days, it seems to be a lot more food-related national days.
Yeah.
But we'll start with the only non-food one we got. It's National Mascot Day. Do you like mascots? You know, the ones that wear costumes at, like, games and stuff.
Well.
Perhaps you're a fan of the Hornet from Georgia Tech.
No, not of that. But I'm trying to think what its name is. There's a mascot for the Minnesota Lynx, and I got to go to the home opener.
Oh.
And there's a thing when you go to something live that you're just, like, a different person. You sing along and to the songs you wouldn't normally do, and then, like, when, what is the Lynx's name, the mascot? Anyway, it's like very exciting if you're anywhere near the mascot at that. And then, you know, I don't know if you know, but the Minnesota Lynx have a tradition. If they win the game, they dance. They do the electric slide.
Oh.
And so you wait for
that.
How do you
do that in the stands, though?
No, the Lynx team does. They go down on the floor. And mascot goes down and does it, too. And it's, for some reason, hilarious to see. Starts with a T, maybe.
No, it's Prowl.
Oh, Prowl. Yeah. It is exciting to see Prowl do the electric slide when they win a game, which they did the other night, and it was fantastic. But anyway, that'd be about the only mascot, you know? What was the mascot of your school growing up?
Well, we were the Storm, but we never had, like, a person in a costume mascot, which was disappointing because I would have done it if we would have had one. Like, if I was a lightning bolt.
Yeah, oh yeah, I could see you doing that.
Or a tornado, and I just spin around on the floor, you know? That would have been fun.
I could see you taking on those leadership roles, like the kids that are coming in later, right? The drum majors, that was a big deal when I was in school, who was the drum major this year for marching band.
Oh, really?
Who was going to run it, yeah.
Yeah, our school never had a marching band.
Oh, so sorry.
It's National Cherry Tart Day.
I don't care.
You don't like cherry tarts?
No.
At all?
I mean, if you made one and offered it to me, I would eat it.
Okay.
I don't think I would ever order it or make it myself, but.
Okay, what about this one? National Apple Strudel Day.
Not so much.
Not a big fan of the summer desserts.
Mm-mm.
All right.
Well, what about doubling up, too. Anyway, sorry.
It's also National Root Beer Day.
Oh, I like root beer a lot.
Do you have a favorite kind of root beer?
A&W, because I worked at A&W for a day and a half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was exciting. I also went to a restaurant last night where they have really good diet root beer. That's basically why I go there to eat.
Oh.
So it's funny you say that. But yeah, A&W was a huge deal when I was growing up to go through where you put the you drive up in your car and they come out and put the tray on your car window. And then there was like a whole thing when it came out in cans when I was a kid, A&W, that you would, you're supposed to hold the can like it was a mug as you drank it. That was the big selling point on that one. So, yeah. Do you like root beer?
I love root beer. I'm more of a Barks guy.
Oh, okay.
I used to get a breakfast meal where it'd be French toast, bacon, and a Barks.